Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Galstaff, you have entered the door to the north. You are now by yourself, standing in a dark room. The pungent stench of mildew emanates from the wet dungeon walls.
Where are the Cheetos?
They're right next to you.
I cast a spell.
Where's the Mountain Dew?
In the fridge, duh.
I want to cast a spell.
Can I have a Mountain Dew?
Yes, you can have a Mountain Dew. Just go get it.
I can cast any of these, right? On the list?
Yes, any of the first level ones.
I'm gonna get a soda. Anyone want one? Hey, Graham, I'm not in the room, right?
What room?
I want to cast Magic Missile.
The room where he's casting all these spells from.
He hasn't cast anything yet.
I am, though, if you'd listen. I'm casting Magic Missile.
Why are you casting Magic Missile? There's nothing to attack here.
I'm attacking the darkness.
Fine. You attack the darkness. There's an elf in front of you.
Whoa!
That's me, right?
He's wearing a brown tunic, and he has gray hair and blue eyes.
No, I don't. I have gray eyes.
Let me see that sheet.
Well, it says I have blue, but I decided I wanted gray eyes.
Whatever. Okay, you guys can talk to each other now if you want.
Hello.
Hello.
I am Galstaff, Sorcerer of Light.
Then how come you had to cast Magic Missile?
you guys are being attacked.
Do I see that happening?
No, you're outside by the tavern.
Cool, I get drunk.
There are seven ogres surrounding you.
How could they surround us? I had Mordenkainen's magical watchdog cast.
No, you didn't.
I'm getting drunk. Are there any girls there?
I totally did. You asked me if I wanted any equipment before this adventure, and I said no. But I need material components for all my spells, so I cast Mordenkainen's faithful watchdog.
But you never actually cast it.
Roll the dice to see if I'm getting drunk.
Yeah, you are.
Are there any girls there?
Yeah.
I did, though. I completely said when you asked me.
No, you didn't. You didn't actually say that you were casting the spell. So now there's ogres, okay?
Ogres? Man, I got an ogre slaying knife. It's got a +9 against ogres.
You're not there. You're getting drunk.
Okay, but if there's any girls there, I want to do them.
Why, hello, it is 43 minutes after the hour of one, and this is the month of March in the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for drawing near, that ye might be informed, amused, and entertained. On this Friday, March 25th, 2011, we are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, looming high above the milkpacking district here in glorious Southeast Portland, the home of all good things. Thank you for joining us. Gather around the wireless, won't you please? If you would like to be part of today's broadcast in a telephonic sense, to give us your comments, questions, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, whatever it is that might be in your brain, that is 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. If you would like to email us, you can do that as well. It's rick@rickemerson.com. It is rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be emailed as well. It's Don, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. Text box open on the website. Also, you can Skype if you like. That is Rick Emerson Show. All one word at the Skype. That is Rick Emerson Show. We're going to eschew the whole opening that we would normally do, where I would just drone on and on in the most tiresome and elaborate fashion about something I did this morning and evolved.
And we talk about our iPhones for like 15 minutes.
I would talk about... Here's the thing. It's like you're inside my head because I had this whole thing. Did you know? And I'm just going to say this right now. I mean, this is going to be sort of a... it's what radio consultant Jack Silver would call it. Guarantees. Did you know that there is now an iPhone app that is solely to guide you to specific books in Powell's downtown on Burnside? It is literally, I swear to God, and I'm not even making it up, they describe it as a turn-by-turn GPS that'll take you to a book in Powell's.
Well, so. I mean, you know, it saves on... Because they have the maps. Because the place is so massive that they have the maps. So why not, sure,
I care less about that than I care about the fact that it's an entree to an endless discussion about iPhone technology, which is, that's really the key to that's the key to success in this brave new world.
The listeners love it when we talk for like a half an hour about our phones.
So we're going to, all of that stuff would just end in some sort of pointless science question, like I would ask why my navel lint is always blue, regardless of what the color is of my wardrobe that day. So we will skip all of that stuff, and you can just sort of, mentally insert it at home if you feel like your life is emptier without it. Before we do anything else, we got to give a little look about what's coming up later on today. And then we'll be joined first and foremost by Paul and Storm. We're going to be performing at the Aladdin tonight. It is tonight, March 25th, a show that, as Kurt Loder would say, you really ought to see. So that is happening tonight, March 25th, Friday, and they'll be joining us on the mic in just a moment. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for your edification on this Friday.
Well, a young daffodil vandals are risking the lives of innocent citizens in England. A man accidentally shoots himself in the face, and another man throws cottage cheese at his girlfriend and locks her in a shed.
The best day ever.
All right.
And meanwhile, I'm sitting mere inches from guys that are miming things at each other about guitar picks and recreational drugs. And they were doing something earlier that involving penises and water bottles. I have no idea what that was.
Here's the other thing that I, less proper gentleman, I would note that that Storm, I believe, was miming along to every single syllable of the Dead Ale Wives sketch just now. So, I mean, that's a thing that may or may not have been happening.
We may or may not have that memorized.
It's, you know, here's the thing is like you have unlocked an achievement on the Rick Emerson Show just by it, well, two of really by doing it and by admitting it as this sort of a social shame gauntlet that you have successfully navigated, sir. Well done.
Thank you. I wouldn't say we're proud, but we're a little bit proud.
No. Here you can embrace. This is a safe place. You can let those feelings out. It's okay.
I do feel safe.
I want you to think of yourself as Timothy Hutton, but me as Judd Hirsch in the cable knit sweater, and then we're all going to cry later on.
I'm already almost in tears.
Does that make you Elizabeth McGovern?
No, I'm Mary Tyler Moore dumping everyone's breakfast down the garbage disposal.
I will give everybody this sort of an introduction just to what you're going to be experiencing here in a few moments if you haven't heard us gushing relentlessly about it all week. Our guest today since 1993 have been staging a glorious oral assault on the world of the musically staid, first as part of Da Vinci's Notebook, about which we will talk more in just a bit, and then as a duo, frequently opening for and accompanying Mr. Jonathan Colton. The most recent album is, and I hope I've got this right, your most recent album is Do You Like Star Wars?
Correct.
Yes. See, I always say that, and then it turns out that they put out like some five-sided sort of, Tarkus-like masterwork that I've completely overlooked. They're going to be seen tonight, March 25th, the Aladdin Theater, along with Hank Green, Mike Furman, and the Double Clicks. Show is at 8 p.m. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio Program, Paul and Storm. Hello, how are you today?
Hello.
Great, terrific.
We're
good
excellent.
Afternoon.
We've also brought with us our good friend Mike Furman, who's sitting approximately 2 feet
behind. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
We often sort of joke about having a webcam in the studio to capture really just nothing, just a lot of us sitting here in black walls. But there, every now and again, there's a moment where that would have been a great idea. And such a moment was during the opening of the show when you guys were – it was like some sort of Marcel Marceau comedy troupe happening just in microcosm off to the right here. So, and Don, meanwhile, was fighting off the urge to Twitter about, oh, my God, I'm sitting right next to Paul and Storm.
I didn't fight that. I snapped a picture and I said, they're here.
It's okay.
In the studio. And immediately got like responses from people going, hi, Paul and Storm. I saw you once 3 years ago. Like, okay.
Tell them I want to do them. Before we do anything else, just the Dead Ale Wives thing, just now playing the fact that is sort of a, it's not like it's the most obscure thing on earth, but it is sort of a cultural shibboleth in a way that, I mean, if you hear that and you know it, because I think it's out of print even. So if you recognize it, you go, Dead Ale Wives, awesome.
That
you know?
Was, here's a fact that nobody cares about. The Dead Ale Wives, the video version that somebody did of that, where they, what was it, one of the original sort of machinima World of Warcraft things, was the very first video I ever saw on YouTube.
Really? And and here's the thing. I am impressed honestly impressed, not in an Eddie Haskell kind of way, that you remember the first thing you saw on YouTube.
I do.
I mean, did you just stumble on it yourself, or did somebody go, get in here, you gotta see this thing?
Yeah, no, it was the latter. It was somebody, have you seen this Dead Ale Wives sketch? No, I haven't.
It's okay, on YouTube.
Well, here, what the heck is this website?
It is YouTube. Funny. It is funny to think that YouTube was not always the default for potato chip video consumption.
Well, and normally there's, you know, the first time you remember somebody showing you a video on the internet, it's usually something horrible. It's usually like a bat fly being extracted out of a guy's neck. And it's something that has scarred them that they want to pass on to others.
Oh, we were scarred by the Dead Alewives. Don't get us wrong about that.
You guys, do you guys find that geek culture is, that it's universal, even, you know, from one town to another? In other words, that an audience in Portland looks very similar to an audience in like Akron, Ohio.
There's variations, but I'd say there's a great consistency overall.
And it's funny. We'll actually often bring the house lights up and announce that indeed this is what the internet looks like in person. That these aren't people that would necessarily congregate physically as much, and geographically it doesn't usually matter like how they're sharing music or videos or whatever it is.
In some ideal world, they're just going to be floating in a saline egg with electrodes, so they don't actually have to leave the house. But for the moment, they sure. all gather under one. I think I saw you guys actually the Aladdin a couple years ago, and one of you had the line about it looked like a Hot Topic had sort of exploded.
Yeah.
All over the audience. Do you writing so much about popular culture, does it ever become a little bit does it ever become taxing or exhausting, I guess? You just wake up at 2 a.m, oh, I got to write something about Rebecca Black. And you immediately just run it. And you feel like if there's some meme that has come out, you just got to work it into a song like today.
Actually, we consciously try and stay away from the more topical stuff for that very reason, just because especially, I mean, we used to occasionally do more parodies. And even in the 5 years we've been doing this, the half-life on any meme or cultural event has gotten so much shorter.
So fast.
You know, I mean, we'll say the words Rebecca Black right now, and a good percentage of your audience knows what we're talking about. But I guarantee you in a month, everybody's going to be way over Rebecca Black. Just like people are already kind of over the whole Charlie Sheen thing. I mean, right. Certainly he's still a punchline.
That double rainbow guy, who's that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you sort of, as soon as you fix it in the amber of a song, you immediately date yourself like an 80s movie that shows an Apple Macintosh or something.
Right. So you're going down with that meme if you're tied to it too closely, unless you're so good and so consistent like Weird Al was for so long with regular parody songs that you can just be the guy who's always going to have the best thing. Auto-tune the News, I think, is the best case of someone who's – or some people who have been able to capitalize on
I mean,
it that way.
We're not saying that there's anything wrong with doing that. I mean, God love people like Auto-tune the News who are willing to put out – have that kind of creative output. But the problem is
– we don't have the discipline.
Yeah, we don't have the discipline. We're lazy. And we don't want to have to generate a new song every 2 weeks.
And besides, Randy Newman is timeless.
He is.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
He's very timeless.
You guys were you were half of your previous band, Da Vinci's Notebook, which is – how did that – this is where I just become James Lipton. How did it begin? Tell me about –
let me speak to Da Vinci's Notebook.
My favorite word is probably –
something happened in Worcester, Massachusetts when you were 12. But how did you guys first come to the meeting? How did you come to be in a band together?
Okay, I'll field this one.
You take it, Paul.
Yeah, it's my turn to give the origin story. We all of us in Da Vinci's Notebook, which was an a cappella band, most of us had done a cappella music of some sort or another in school. And each of us were coming out of college or near the end of our college careers and had wanted to do a little bit more. And we joined a pickup group that some guy had put together. And that only lasted a couple of months over the summer. But sort of the core four of us sort of remained together. We had more in common than the others and thought we had some sort of special spark.
Like the original group was really pure doo-wop. It was covers of Duke of Earl and Teenager in Love, that kind of thing. And we wanted to do stuff that was some more current, but just sort of more kind of inventive stuff.
And when you say a pickup group, is that sort of an ad hoc?
Like guy put an ad in the paper, said, hey, join an a cappella group. Come do auditions. And
I like the idea that at one end of the school or whatever, there's a guy doing like a pickup basketball game. And then meanwhile, near the drama class room, there's a guy, undoubtedly a pasty person, saying, who wants to put together an ad hoc a cappella group? It's going to be awesome.
That was happening back in our colleges. That was kind of how it was like.
We were this great renaissance of a cappella.
Did you have a specific inspiration for that? I guess the Bobs were the only.
Yeah, the Bobs are absolutely a direct inspiration. We actually covered a lot of their songs back before we started doing our own original material. That was a strong influence on our performing style and.
And Rockapella was another band.
Rockapella.
You can count on one hand, pretty much, the number of people who've been able to make a living of some sort with acapella. So, of course, those bands are the ones you look up to. And at the time, it was the Bobs, Rockapella, the Nylons, which weren't strictly acapella, but they did sort of a newer version of doo-wop as well.
A poppier sound.
So before the advent of the internet, it was how did you get noticed? How did you gain traction? Was it live performances or was it?
At first it was just, you know, how any band does stuff. You go out and you perform at a bunch of open mics and you very slowly gather a following in your hometown and then you start performing around a little bit and you perform for 6 people in Madison, Wisconsin. You go back in 6 months and perform for 12. And
we had we did the local festival circuit, so we had a fan base locally, and then we caught a series of very lucky breaks that led to us being on the Today Show, where they did a feature on us connected with an acapella competition. And then suddenly with that exposure, we were starting to get a higher level of gigs and we were gigging more often and we got better and started doing original material too.
What was the, for each of you guys, what was the thing what's the first song you remember loving? The first song that really you heard something, you went, my God, like what is that?
Just growing up listening
anything,
to?
Anything. Right? Well, because you hear music growing up and it's like whatever your parents have or your siblings.
Right.
But there comes this sort of this event horizon where you hear something that sort of just cuts through. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like the beam of light comes down and you say, my God, here it is.
It was Help by the Beatles. And the Beatles were pretty much the only music in my entire cabinet at home growing up that wasn't a musical or Barbra Streisand or something like that. And that song, when I heard it, I would just start running around the room in circles with my...
He still does.
I still do that sometimes.
Did you discover it yourself or did you hear it playing or what was the... Do you remember the moment when you first heard it?
It was playing, and I was very young. I couldn't have been older than 3 or 4, but I remember that song in particular cutting through, and that was the song. And that really up until about the age of 10, I was obsessed with that red and blue album that they had.
Do you know what it was? Could you quantify what it was about it that was so powerful? Do you have any way to?
I do. At the time, I didn't think of it this way, but it had a sense of mortality to it. Like it was very serious, but at the same time, fun and that kind of cognitive dissonance. And as a 3-year-old, I probably did not use the term cognitive dissonance, but I think that's
no need for false humility, sir.
I know. Okay, I did. In fact, I coined the term when I was 4.
It was so adorable.
And so he had the Beatles. You had.
For me, well, I liked a lot of music. The first thing I can think of that I actually really latched on to, though, might be Tom Lehrer records. My parents had the full collection of Tom Lehrer music, and I was always a sort of precocious, annoying little kid, even very young. And something about Tom Lehrer. I mean, it was even though I couldn't catch half of the political 1960s, 1950s references.
Oh, now you're being modest.
Okay. I could. I knew who Alma Mahler was.
Trotskyism. Oh, mother, when will lunch be ready?
But it was so obviously smart and well crafted, and wow, there's a very loud vehicle going by outside.
You know,
or is
we
that
tried
your
to
phone ring.
I just heard. It's funny because just as we were getting, Mike was like, "I got to put my phone in airplane mode," and I said, "Yeah, you better put your phone in airplane." And then I just realized now that there's a little burst of static happening because mine is not in airplane mode, and also there is a train that goes by every now and again, and we always sort of tell people, "Well, it doesn't show up. We'll take it out in post. We'll figure." And they don't. And we don't take it out in post because it actually doesn't show up. Amazingly enough, but which is odd because you can hear it with like absolute crystal clarity when you're here. Your parents had the Tom Lehrer, the collection. They actually had those records. It wasn't a thing that you. It wasn't a thing.
No,
that
it's
you
not
heard.
A thing. I sought out. It was just something that you know they had enjoyed, and we would play them, and I just loved how smart they were.
That's fantastic.
And the incredible craft that went into them.
Well, and Lehrer, Storm mentioned that Help has a certain manic, a certain mania to it. There's a certain streak of very poppy paranoia that runs through that song. Mm-hmm. Tom Lehrer, of course, has the whimsical gleam in the eye of evil, but it's a sort of fun-loving.
Yeah, but there's a very sort of acerbic,
yeah,
not quite angry, but kind of miffed. undertone.
It's
to
arch.
All of, yeah, very. Yeah,
he's carrying a shiv. You can tell.
Yeah.
When did you make for either of you guys? When did you make the decision? Like, this is what you wanted to do for a living. Like I'm going to be a musician.
You know, it was almost. I can't speak for Paul. He can speak for himself in a moment. But I sort of felt like I was in denial that it was what I wanted to do for most of my life. And sort of, you look back and you say, okay, I was always in the little school elementary productions, and then high school the theater stuff, and always had, you know, I had a doo-wop group in high school, and then in college, even as I was getting a degree, I was paying more attention to the a cappella. But it was really when Da Vinci's Notebook started to get that kind of success when we were on the Today Show that it was like, whoa, there really is a way to do this for a living. So it wasn't until that moment.
Yeah,
that
I was sort of
it was
same,
real.
I was in the same boat of where, you know, it's not like I ever said, you know, I am going to be a musician or performer for a living. It was something I certainly always enjoyed and thought wouldn't it be awesome if. And Da Vinci's Notebook really sort of, I mean, it started out very much as just a hobby group, and over a course of a number of years, it became a little bit more than a hobby, and we'd start doing paying gigs, and then it was sort of a part-time job, and then it was a second full-time job, and we hit a point where we realized, you know.
We're going to be fired anyway.
Yeah, we're going to be fired anyway. Let's go ahead and take the leap.
So now there's probably X number of people in the audience who are screaming at me to ask this because – so I will just say that this show has been on one form or another in Portland for a better part of 13 years. And for about 10 of those years, I will say that we're fans of very hyper-specific kinds of news. People being killed by nail guns or wood chippers, someone being assaulted by a clown, or anybody dressed as a mascot doing something horrible.
Cannibals, for example.
Cannibals, for
example. Love a good cannibal story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And
who
so,
doesn't?
And a lot of these sort of niches, these genres of news are things in which we are so interested that they become their own segments on the show. And then they have accompanying theme music. And so for about 10 years, any story involving penises, usually penis being severed or stuck into something, you know, sort of ill-advisedly, has been accompanied by, you know, and it's everything as a watch. There's the penis watch or the clown watch or the taser watch. And the penis watch theme has been Enormous Penis by
sure.
Da Vinci's Notebook.
It's our magnum opus.
So it's now, having said that, let's cut back to about 2 years ago when we had when Jonathan Colton was in the studio and you guys had you were there and were doing some of the backup vocals. And I just for whatever reason, I had never connected all the dots. Uh-huh. And so Colton is there and he's singing, you know, robot, scientist, zombie. And, you know, it was done great and it was fantastic and everybody sort of left. And then I think we just went to the phones or something, or I checked my email, and it was just an endless scene. He was going, "You fool! You had the Enormous Penis guys in the studio! You've missed your chance!"
For years now, people have been giving him, and now by extension me, just complete crap about that.
I mean, it was just...
It's going to be your deathbed regret, is it?
I felt like Chaz Palminteri at the end of Usual Suspects. You know, the cripple! Where was he? You know, So I have to ask, and if you opt not to, I'll certainly understand. But could you favor with at least a little bit of that song?
Is
that
we have not
a thing
played
you
this
do?
In a number of years.
You'd
so...
make a very special boy very happy.
Is that the key? Is it?
Yeah.
Whenever life gets you down, keeps you wearing a frown, and the gravy train has left you behind. Ticket store.
And when you're all out of hope, down at the end of your rope, and nobody's there to throw you a line.
So far, so good. If you ever get so low that you don't know which way to go, come on and take a walk in my shoes. Never worry about a thing, got the world on a string, 'cause I've got the cure. For all of my blues.
All of my blues.
I take a look at my enormous penis, and my troubles start a-melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and the happy times are coming to stay. I gotta sing and I dance when I glance in my pants. In the field it's like a sunshiny day. I take a look at my enormous penis. Cut to the end and everything is going my way.
My trouser monster.
Everything is going my way.
My meat is murder.
Everything is going my way. that way. It's the milk packing district.
Everything is going my way.
That's fantastic. That is really, and if you could see inside my head right now, it's like at the end of Revenge of the Sith. There's just a closing of a circle, and now
that's
everything.
Because you're going no. we'll have another
performance from you guys, because you probably have something that is not 13 years old. But for people who have not come to see you guys, or they haven't heard you,
It's just that song about 20 times in a row.
I was going to ask. I mean, is there any way that you have arrived at how to describe your show for people who haven't experienced it?
That is the ever elusive.
The boring term is like comedy music or nerd folk comedy. None of those really are particularly exciting descriptive terms. How about you, Mike? Mike, by the way, is also half of a very, very funny comedy music duo, Hard and Firm, if you're familiar with them. They did the Pie Song and...
so it's a small fraternity of people that have no idea how to describe themselves.
Have you guys ever come up with a proper adjective?
No. Comedy music is as good as I get, and it's awful.
I had written down at one point, I was sort of just brainstorming some questions, and I had written something about, you know, other, I used the phrase other comedians, and then I sort of angrily scratched it out because I felt like I was diminishing you in some way. But I think Don and I were talking about this the other day. I had this sort of waves of reaction, I think, the first time I saw you guys live, and I think it was probably 3 or 4 years ago with Colton at the Aladdin. And as you note in the song Opening Band, you know, it's 90% of the time you go to see some artist, you know, and it's especially the more mainstream the artist, it seems like the more disinterested you are in whoever's opening.
Yes.
It's
the opening act is to be tolerated at best.
Exactly. Yeah. And you just.
And I had been telling Rick, I'm going, no, these guys are great. He's like, yeah.
Storm.
So, yeah, I'm here to see Colton. And he did. He actually, you guys came out, you started doing the opening band. He sat up. He actually set the coffee aside, had to look at the I think I might actually listen to
what is this?
Besides, coffee is for closers.
it was quite a revelation. It was amazing, and it was because I typically I've sort of modulated this opinion over the years, but I just loathe comedians, and I loathe musical comedians.
we do too.
That's the thing, is you just see a guy and say, I'd like to do a little number for you, call me, go, oh God, kill me.
Like, yeah. Okay, now if Bob Dylan was to be on Sesame Street, it might sound a little something like this.
Can I try a metaphor on you?
Yes.
I hope this works. Imagine if your favorite sketch comedy group, so if you're really into Kids in the Hall, whatever it is, just did musical songs, set piece musical songs. That's the vibe.
And that's probably a good way to – and it is also – the other thing that you guys do very, very well is – and it's always a little terrifying, is the sort of interplay with the audience where there's this – I mean the vibe always just seems to teeter on the brink of complete and total implosion. It never quite falls apart, which is what makes it so glorious. But it seems like at any moment there's going to be this complete nerd pandemonium that sort of breaks out.
Yeah, well, we like to live on the edge.
when did people first start – I mean, you get – I mean, you know, the thing of where you're playing and guys are just shouting stuff at you, which most artists immediately they have security go down and just like, you know, shatter the guy's spine.
That dates to the Da Vinci's Notebook days, that we were ourselves so ADD riddled that it was this constant explosion, and we saw no reason not to include the audience in that. And we actually get thrown when audiences don't shout. Like we did a high school where I guess the last assembly they had, they were rambunctious and they were instructed, do not shout, just politely listen. And it was one of the worst shows we ever had. We were trying to get the audience to play. And
they tittering politely in their seats.
Yeah, well, staring with horror, you know, wanting to shout things out as we tell them to and looking over at the teachers.
Paul and Storm are here. They're going to be at the Aladdin tonight. That is tonight, 8 p.m., along with Hank Green, Mike Furman, who's in the studio as well, and the Double Clicks. And I'm sort of giving up my street cred with this, but the Double Clicks, I was not familiar with until I went online last night. I was sort of, you know, talking to
they made us discover them.
Yeah. We had not been familiar with them. We were made aware of their presence, listened to their stuff, and we're like, hey, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And they're local, so we don't have to pay for a hotel room. Sure, yeah. You guys can play.
Well, it's like every time you guys come through and every time Colton comes through, it's like they sort of dragging along with you some bit of genius of which I was not previously. You know, like I am
Molly
forgetting her name.
Lewis?
Was it Molly the,
Molly Lewis,
the ukulele player who did gained some fame on the internet with her cover of Toxic by Britney Spears.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then – and again, it was that thing of like, ukulele, Christ, I'm going to check Twitter. But then immediately it's like the best song I had ever heard in my life, which she said like, well, I just dashed this off in 4 minutes last night. And it was a song about graduating from high school, and it was sort of a message to her graduating class about it was called I Hope Your Kids Find Your Face, or Your MySpace Page.
Yep. Yep.
And it was just freaking brilliant. I mean, it was just – and it is one of those things that – I mean, I can switch on the maudlin mode pretty easily when it comes to music or when it comes to discovering new songs or new bands or whatever. But it is that thing that really does give you – it does feed the flame of love of music, because mm-hmm. every now and again, I think especially as you get older – we have a friend of ours who actually just said that he got to be about 32 years of age, and he looked at his record collection. And he went, "Well, I'm set. I think I'm good. I got my Thin Lizzy. Really, what else do I need?" And I understand that, but I also work very hard not to be that guy. And
yeah.
So when I see somebody, especially somebody that you'd never heard of, somebody's totally you're unfamiliar with them, and they come out and they just like floor you. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that is as good as it gets. It's just amazing. People, again, you can go online to paulandstorm.com to find out more. Or you can go to Ticketmaster to get tickets.
Or get them at the door.
Or just barrel your way in angrily and with gusto. Would you guys would you like to perform a little something else for us? What would you like to play?
Well, you mentioned the opening band fact.
You pick, Storm.
Oh gosh, opening band I think is a nice one.
This was our ethos for the first 6 years of our existence, and we've only been together for five.
Yeah, and we wrote this. It was sort of an accumulation of our experiences and the fact that we knew we were going to be an opening band again, as opposed to Da Vinci's Notebook.
We are the opening band. We are here to do five or six or seven songs. Don't go too long and get the hell off the stage. We are the opening band. We're probably not the band you came to see tonight, but it's alright, cause soon we'll go away. And we're wondering just where the hell's the sound guy. He disappeared just after we got up here. He's probably behind the building rolling up a fatty, and he'll be gone until our last song. We got the VW band. Celery Star Wars figure that I had, and asked my dad to co-sign for the loan. We don't got a whole lot of fans. Nobody asked for our autograph, and sad to say, as of today, no panties have been thrown. And we're wondering if this was worth the drive in. We spent 6 hours in traffic on the highway for $50 and half price on the cheese fries and free Miller Lite on tap. Who can drink that crap? My cousin lives in town and will be crashing at his place unless his girlfriend's home from college and she's staying for the weekend. And if she is, then we will have to go and park the van behind the IHOP by the turnpike, and we'll sleep in the back seat. And we're wondering just where the headline act is. Probably getting wasted in the green room, and they don't give a rat's ass who we are. So when they start to play up here, we're gonna drink all their beer. We are the opening band. We hope that all of you sign up on our mailing list and buy our disc and t-shirts in black and gray. We are the opening band, and we only got about 25 more minutes left. That's all we get to blow your ass away. We are the opening band. We are the opening band. Hello. Hello. Hello.
That's fantastic.
Thank you. That song actually was released on Rock Band a couple of years back, and through no means of our own, the people who programmed it made it really hard. And beyond that, we also we get a lot of angry emails from people mad at us for that last note because it always messes up their 100% rating.
Now, have you played it? You
yes.
guys on
yeah.
Rock Band? How
yeah.
did you do?
Pretty poorly, actually. Especially on drums. We had a terrific drummer, Eddie Hartness, from a band called Eddie from Ohio, played drums on that, and he's like a knockdown,
like
drag out.
Like a real drummer, yeah. an actual musician.
So, for people who have not, that is the song that you actually opened the show with, I think, most of the time. It's going to be a cavalcade of amusements and delights and wonders. Mike Furman also in the studio.
Yeah.
So if you want to sort of cram your way,
yeah.
sort of
please yeah. do. I think Mike should perform a song.
No,
Mike
Furman. Mike does a song.
He's saying all this nah while he's grabbing his guitar and doing.
You know, Mike, it'll make you look grown up if you do it.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
All the cool kids. All the cool kids are performing songs.
Let's see. Let's see. What should I? What do you think? How do the? I could do the cover. I could do. I do. That's the thing about doing comedy music, and what I do is oftentimes try to mock music. So I'm kind of taking away music out of the music world's music collection. So everything is significantly different than the other thing. So I could do the cover that I do, which is, I guess I'll do
you
that.
You could do that, or you could do That Was Me.
Yeah, That Was Me, I think.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
So this is not a cover. This is a song
you're going to have to come to the show to hear the cover, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right. This is a song that I wrote, and it's about relationships. And it's a, it's a guitar comedy song. this is not terribly...
Don't overhype it, man.
Mike is the most literal comedian you will ever meet.
This is a comedy guitar music song, and I am going to play it now.
Let me tell you why I hate myself. All right, here we go. So, I'm glad we're moving on, that we've both gotten over it. Our breakup was pretty bad there for a while. I look back and feel stupid, it's stupid, I was mad, I've been so juvenile. But now that's all over, and peace has been made, and there's just one little thing unsaid that needs to be said. So like, that time a guy drove by and threw a sandwich at your head, that was me. Last Thursday night when the nightclub said they lost your coat, that was me. Social Security believes that you are dead, thanks to me. When in the shower you found that tongue instead of soap, well, that was me. That was me. I feel pretty good. The truth is coming out, and I'm just glad we didn't let things go too far. I may have spent $591.18 ruining your life, but I can't afford to let our friendship fall apart. Thank God that's all over. The pain's at an end, and we can be happy as friends. I think enough time has passed that we can look back and laugh. I know I can. The last three chapters of all your books that were all torn out, that was me. Who signed you up for the Scientology mailing list? That was me. Somebody peed in your Brita, and that somebody's me. And who wrote that email virus hoping it would get to you? And I'll bet it did. That was me. That was me. Then someone told you I was sorry in a note left on your door. Well, that was my roommate, and because of that, he's no one's roommate anymore. I think we've learned a lot from this. God knows I have. 'Cause I've learned how to sign your name and plug your drain and make it rain and plant drugs and drug your plants and shrink your pants, post videos of you throwing up in your hands. And I was responsible for the events of September 11th, 2008, the year somebody stuck a banana in your grandma's tailpipe.
And when I say tailpipe, I'm really sorry. And that time you thought there was just one more stare, that was me. And when that guy hit your new boyfriend with a bat, that was not me. But he did it on my behalf for a fee. That filled in crossword, that was me. Your new car was dirty, someone washed me on the hood with a key and shot your dog into space. That time you got drunk at the costume party, hooked up with that Japanese dude that never called you back. Hi! And on that online message board, who said you should go rent Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull? I didn't think you'd actually do it. That was me, the old me.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Furman, who you can see tonight along with Paul and Storm and the Double Clicks.
And Hank Green.
And Hank Green. And that is all starting tonight, 8 o'clock. You can get tickets at the door or at Ticketmaster.com. You can find out more at paulandstorm.com. This is you're a very strange person, Mike Furman. let's talk about your rather unusual approach to wit.
Wit is kind of a binary thing. Either you do it or don't.
So, Mike Furman, where do you get off? Where do you come from? What a fantastic time this is to do what you guys do. Because, you know, there was Weird Al, and there was Stan Freeberg, and Alan Sherman, and Tom Lehrer. But you can list those guys because except for the sort of golden age of the novelty song, there wasn't a lot of opportunity in the mainstream to do this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You weren't able to really communicate with the fans directly. And the internet, I mean, obviously just leveled, you know, that playing field entirely. Do you think – is it a wash, though? In other words, does the internet make it easier to get known but harder to stay current, harder to stay relevant?
I think that's an accurate observation, and the dynamic's a little different. Like talking about auto-tune the news, it definitely helps if you can add a visual element to it, if it can be video as well. People are much more inclined, the way they consume media, to sit down for 3 minutes in front of something if there's visual stimulation. It's not like the novelty songs where you listen to the radio all day or wherever you were and it would come on and that was that. So it does make it a little harder.
And you guys have done both. You've been on, you've had a label that was putting your music onto plastic discs and sending it to stores. And, I would imagine maybe the bulk of your stuff, if not the overwhelming majority of it now, is sold online or heard online.
And not because the discs are gone, it's because the stores are gone.
Yeah. And has it been a net gain for you guys in terms of...
Overall, yeah, it's absolutely been a net gain. I mean, we release our music with a Creative Commons license, and what that means, it's sort of an adjusted copyright where basically you give people permission once they... If somebody has purchased your song, they have permission to give it away to somebody else or ate somebody else's or make a derivative work like a video to go along with it that they can then post as long as they give proper attribution to the original creators.
And don't use it for commercial purposes.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's a lot of people like Metallica who might get really mad at that kind of thing. But for people at a scale like us, the added exposure that we get from somebody sharing our music with 15 of their friends is very much a net gain because some percentage of those people will come and show up at a live performance and or buy a CD or a T-shirt when they get there.
Or just send us money. It happens sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you guys, and there's a real deep loyalty. There is a genuine connection. And all that stuff that every band says that is usually just so much hokum, where they talk about there's a real an interactive dynamic and a real sort of a shared affection. Mm-hmm. And it is obvious to even the most casual observer seeing you guys perform and Colton and that, you know, where it's there's that energy that sort of exists in the space between
the nerd energy.
The nerd energy.
And that's what the Creative Commons thing does, is it engages them and makes them part of the whole thing. Like they're actually a part of the team now.
Yeah.
You know?
And for similar reasons, I'm thankful every day for Twitter and Facebook, because for a band like us where, you know, we're not mass appeal, it enables us to be in the mind of our fans consistently and, you know, tell them jokes or send them things that we think is interesting so that when we do have something, a new song or a project or that we're working on, they're already tuned in. It's not like, you know, it's so tough for Weird Al over the years, he's at the mercy of the record right. labels and who it is and if they're going to release it or not. But now an artist can just go directly that way and stay in people's minds.
Speaking of Twitter and the you know the geek social circle, I don't know. We've been talking for X number of minutes, so I think I'm legally required to talk about Will Wheaton at some point. I had this theory. This is one of those many ideas. I do what a lot of people do, which is about 2 in the morning, I go, I have the best idea for a website. And then it's like, you know, I should register that domain name. And then later I'm looking at my bill from, you know, Yahoo or whatever, going like, why do I own 75 domain names that I've – but I had this idea for something called the Wheaton Index, and it was going to be a thing that through some algorithm that I would – you know, have someone else write. it would calculate your proximity to and your connections to Will Wheaton.
Like
and
a Kevin Bacon version of Will.
Exactly. And sort of come up with like a, you know, your Wheaton index is 75. and it was, and you know, the higher the number, the higher you were in the geek hierarchy. When did he become the, you know, the sort of paradigm marker?
Wow.
It was another slow process for him. I know, I mean, we're going to give a very poor summary of the actual facts, but basically he was child actor and then a young adult actor, and his career was not really progressing, certainly not in the direction that he wanted it to. So he stopped for a while and actually worked for a software company and to just, you know, really distance himself and gain some perspective on himself and his life and sort of come to terms with himself, because I've heard him say in interviews there was a while there where he was very angry and he realized he didn't like himself and he had to figure out why that was. And a lot of it was sort of his own expectations of how his life and career was going to go. And in that reevaluation process, it happened to coincide with sort of the birth of blogging and whatever compelled him to say, you know what, I am going to just start writing my thoughts on the internet and see what comes of it.
And I think, again, this top of the head, part of the appeal was here was this guy that so many people knew his character, especially on The Next Generation, that by many people reviled that character for whatever reason. And then here he is. You're hearing his direct thoughts. It was a new idea of this public blog and realize, whoa, you know, there's actually a person behind right. this person that mm-hmm. some people have been vilifying. And there was a lot of a lot of connection to that, and he was
That was part of his reevaluation process. He realized, you know, okay, I am a nerd, and I am perfectly okay with that fact, and I'm going to embrace it rather than treat it like some sort of, you know, social disease or something that I need to suppress.
Well, it also helped that he's actually a very good writer.
Yeah,
that drew a lot of people to him who were like, wow, this Wheaton can actually like spin a tale. Mm-hmm. You know, because he is a very good writer.
And he wasn't doing it as, and he wasn't doing it strictly for marketing or PR. He wasn't doing it as a shill. He was there writing because he wanted to write and he had things to.
Exactly. And it was sort of a perfect storm of here is this person who was famous on a very particularly geeky, you know, show. Who also happened to be a really nice person, an excellent writer, and a geek. And, you know, given the venue he was in of the internet, he suddenly had very direct access to the exact demographic that his appeal was best for.
And yeah, he was talking about the things that he loved, and it just happened to be, just like with Jonathan Coulton, that these were subjects that people who were spending a lot of time online were drawn to.
And he was there, I think, not unconquered territory, but it wasn't. It was before, I think,
it was
a critical mass.
Very new, but like blogging was very, very new. He wasn't the first by any means, but it was an untapped, unexplored market, certainly.
It'd be interesting to see, but I think he might be the first person you consider to be a celebrity blogger.
I think our friend John Rogers, I think, said that it was sort of like the internet, that the world of blogging was with sort of this island that everybody was sort of paddling out to. And when they got there, like Wheaton was there, and he'd like built a chalet, you know, and he's like, "Welcome to my place."
I mean, it's like podcasting. I mean, speaking just for myself, there was a very long time where I just sort of didn't get it, you know, and Twitter the same way, where you just mm-hmm. don't quite, okay, wait, you just sort of sit there and you ramble about stuff and then you put it out on the internet and people choose to download it and listen to it. Why would you? And at a certain point, suddenly something clicked. Like, oh, that's right. You can listen to things that are very directly about things that you want to listen to, or you can hear what people have to say whose opinion you like and whose writing style you like, and it clicks.
Yeah, I remember being blown away, speaking of Twitter, and it's all part of the same continuum, just these different ways of doing it, reaching people directly. I sort of got it when had been on it a little bit, and then the word went around and I can't imagine how the word went around now, that the word now goes around through Twitter and Facebook, but that John Cleese had started and that, oh my gosh, it actually is him.
Right.
It was someone had vouched for it and it was known. And suddenly it was incredible that traditionally you have celebrity and there's someone up on a pedestal and it's set up that way. And
there's layers of people between you and him and publicists and
agents. Yeah. And with each one of these layers, probably not starting with blogs, but it's become more and more direct, mm-hmm. which is especially great for artists who are not Metallica and who are not the big names with big money behind them.
I mean, even neither of us or none of the three of us, I think, hold any, you know, aspirations that we're going to be massive rock stars and live in our mansions with our golden swimming pools or whatever.
We're too old for that now.
You know, even with a Weird Al Yankovic, who is wonderful and very talented and very popular, even that still sort of – he has a certain niche appeal that he's never really going to go beyond with novelty music or whatever you want to call it. But the beauty of the internet is, you know, you don't have to – pray and get signed by a record label and then hope that you catch on. It just gives you a far easier access to that group of several 10,000 or 100,000 people who are really into this kind of thing. And then, you know, hope you still have to, you know, follow through with having actual talent and not sucking.
and making content
and all of that. But
until the money, people figure out how to game it like they did rock and roll.
Yeah, exactly.
Ruin it for everybody.
Right. Well, it is fascinating that you mentioned Cleese, the idea that I can just, I could just sit here and then Nathan Fillion type something and it just appears, and then I just sort of read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's one of those things where, you know, if you think about it too much, you just end up in some like weird Escher painting inside your head about how just freaking weird and amazing and just almost, you know, that thing about Arthur C. Clarke said about, you know, advanced technology being indistinguishable from magic, that it just seems impossible sometimes. And yet it's just here for, you know, 99 cents at the iTunes store or whatever, you know, insert app here that does magical thing.
I'm just sitting here noticing that Paul has the same style phone that I do. So I was wondering if there was some way I could swap them out and then just crank call John Hodgman.
he'd love
like
that.
Like me too, all the time.
Yeah.
Actually, that segues perfectly into, as we sort of wrap this up, you guys are going to be sound checking at the venues right down the road from us. So it's if you have not got tickets now, really you whatever you have to do to get the money, frankly, they just they don't care. Get the money, however you know, and I will alibi for you
if
necessary.
You have to beat somebody in front of the venue who has tickets in order to steal their tickets and get in. We're okay with
that. We don't want you to.
We don't endorse it, but we don't condemn.
And it has been known to happen in that neighborhood. So you know,
we don't judge.
That actually, the Aladdin. I saw Paul Stanley. He did a solo tour about 2-3 years ago. He was just out. I don't know. Gene was doing whatever, and so Paul's like, you know, I have to go see the people. And so he did it. And I love Paul Stanley, but sure. He came to the Aladdin and he played. And at one point, this is the show where literally a woman screamed out. She's like, "Play Harder Than Hell," and he just goes, "Give me $5," and she. And she said, "Okay." And she did, that's how well Kiss has got their audience program, by the way. She went, "All right." And she only had two. And she hands it. And so he just says, "Well, okay, you get one. You get one stanza and a chorus." And he sits down at the edge of the stage with his guitar, and just him with the electric guitar without the band. And he just sang one verse, one chorus of Hotter Than Hell and wrapped it up. And then he put his hand and he goes, "Give me your $2. And she like handed him. He put it in the pocket. And he's like, "That was sweet." And he just. But that was the venue where out front. This doesn't happen a lot, but where there was a man who was well into his cups, who was, I think, resisting the command to go home that had been issued to him first by the venue, then by the cops, and where the crowd was gathered around watching it. And at one point, it was so magical. The crowd just sort of shared like a Jungian consciousness. Everybody just began going, "Taser, taser, taser," and then it didn't happen.
The cop said, "Give me $5." And only hit two, so he gave him a 9-volt against his tongue.
Thank you guys so much for coming in, and really, honestly, sincerely, you know, as somebody who loves music, to, you know, to people who make music, thank you for being out there and doing what you do. It means a lot, and best of continued success in all things.
Thank you.
We had a really terrific time here.
It was.
I only had a moderately.
I had a terrific time.
I had the rest of Paul's good time.
Yeah.
Paul and Storm, Mike Furman, Hank Green, and the Double Clicks all going to be at the Aladdin tonight. That is at 8:00. Go to paulandstorm.com, Ticketmaster, or tickets available at the venue as well. This is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We continue next. Stay right there. Go nowhere. We return momentarily.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
You doing that thing you do, breaking my heart.
To the Emerson News Network. We'll be right back.
Does anything change when you're old?
Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964. Are you just going to sit and look at the photograph of you posing with Paul and Stone?
I'm trying to find just like the perfect sort of filter to make it look all warm, and because we're under fluorescent lights, and you know that's not good for anyone. So I'm trying different filters.
Are you looking for a filter that just superimposes Liz Taylor's face over your own?
I'm just trying to find one that just makes me look less rotund, really. Just and that's not possible.
No. That's called the Paula Abdul filter. It's where you suddenly are 12 feet tall and pencil thin.
Like those old Heart videos where they just stretch to...
Can we put you in a welding mask and also have you stand over there? And look, we're going to point the camera the other direction, too. Just FYI. Thanks. No, you look great, Anne. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Okay, can we just nerd for just a second?
Oh, my God!
How awesome was that?
Now that they're gone, I can just, like, squee and just... Oh, that was so awesome.
What is to squee?
You know, that's nerd talk for when you go, ee!
Except
you're, like, way excited about
you're
something.
The only person I've ever heard use that word, though. Because you said that to me in an email once, and I wondered if it was, like, a Don Taylor original. Like, if you're trying to introduce that word to the lexicon.
No, that's an internet nerd phrase.
Please to spell.
S-Q-U-E-E.
Okay. So Paul and Storm and Mike Furman, who were just, were all fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, and hey, the penis song.
And they did the penis song right here, live.
I might as well take my own life.
I didn't want them to leave. I wanted them to just stay forever and ever. I was having so much fun.
She said in a Wilkesian sort of way. Oh, my penguin always faces due south. You're listening to the...
I put my head on his shoulder when we had our picture taken.
Rick Emerson Radio Program. Okay. Let's welcome now our good friend, Mr. Big Jim Willig from New Memory Comedy One. Hello, sir.
Hello.
Sir, we're running. We're all just agog and a something today. We're all
not a problem at all. No, those guys are incredible. I didn't realize just how much of their music I already enjoyed without really knowing who they were.
They did. I discovered this last night that one of the early Da Vinci's notebook songs that I knew, but I didn't know it was them. Next time they come through town, or we'll have them on again, we'd even get a chance to talk about to nerd over our shared love of Dr. Demento.
Oh, yeah.
But they did a song called The Gates. And The Gates is this great a cappella song, and it's all about a guy going to Bill Gates' house to beat him to death with a shovel or something because Windows 95 like freezes up and won't work. And it's this great like a cappella epic tale about, and then I went to face the gates, but I somehow didn't know it was them because you know, listen to Dr. Demento, and Dr. Demento, you know, it's 2 hours of novelty records, and some of them a cappella, and some of them, you know, kind of sound like other things. But I mean, they're just great. And smart and funny in the best sense of both of those words. And I understand why
we're
they don't
glad
like
to have you here too, Jim.
Yeah.
You're good at many things. Look, you're a nice boy. You've got a sweet spirit, Jim.
Yeah, I do stuff.
The thing about it is, like, those guys have like, not them in particular, but any guy who's on stage being funny with a guitar has a huge hurdle with me because I instinctively dislike, you know, that I am just prepped to hate anyone on stage telling jokes with a guitar.
It's very polar. polarizing. You know, it's either you love them to death.
Well, it's like
they either
like,
do it like incredibly well, or it is just a very easy turn into like catastrophe.
Well, you know,
I have the same reaction to anyone who does impressions.
That's the thing. It's like, yeah, you got to earn it. Like, okay, you do impressions. You know, the stakes. You really have to wow me like instantly.
Yeah.
And you don't just have to be kind of funny. You have to be fantastic. That's why like the only impressionist I've ever really gotten to was Gas, because he does the same thing that they do, where he kind of deconstructs it a little bit. So it's been a couple weeks, because last week you ended up not coming in last Friday. You were in last Monday or
no,
something.
No, I was in Monday and Friday.
Monday and Friday.
Just kind of...
We didn't do the comedy thing, but he was here holding my hand and keeping me company, and we did a little song, a little dance.
Oh, that's right. You sang the top five song.
Yes, okay. We did.
Brushed her hair 100 strokes and sang the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Okay.
Just to keep her strong.
How are things?
Things are well. Things are good. You know,
so I saw you, was it last night? When was that?
Two nights ago.
KUFO thing?
It was the Wednesday was the wake.
So, where we were all just at the Grand Central Bowl, and I don't know, we kind of talked about this a lot on Thursday, but I just, you know, just a whole building full of people. I'm not even saying the people I disliked, just people that I don't know. I mean, I knew you, you know, there's like, you know, like 10% of the people that I knew or knew fairly well. And then everybody else was just some guy that I recognized because he worked in like some cubicle in the sales area for like 3 months, like 5 years ago.
Yeah, I remember making awkward eye contact with you during in the lunchroom. Yeah,
there's different levels of friendship and of relationship. Like there's that thing where you, I think this is a guy thing too. There's that thing where you will pass a guy in the hallway and you both do that tight smile where you arch your eyebrows. You know you.
Yeah,
that,
there we
right
go.
There.
Yeah.
And that's
like no lip showing at all.
You don't show any teeth. You keep, but yeah, you do the big smile with your mouth sealed shut, and then you arch your eyebrows, and that's a whole like, we're not going to talk, but I'm acknowledging your presence and pretending that I like you.
Because I'm not a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe you like him, maybe you don't. You don't even know. You have no idea who he is. So it was at the Sleep Country thing where it's like half the people at half the lanes were like, Rick, you know, hey, long time. I'm like, yeah,
yeah.
No idea who you
There's
are.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah, I
thank you, caller ID.
God almighty.
Well, no, it was like 90% or 95% like salespeople.
Yeah.
And only, which I could never remember their names for the life
of
me.
And the thing, let's be honest, they're salespeople. They're just there to use the drink tickets. That's it. There's a tab and they're there to use the tab. Somebody that I cannot tell you, we just, at our listener party, the Rick Emerson listener party, we just flat out quit having a drink tab or any sort of like, a, you know, because there would be like, there was a thing where they would say like, well, look, you got like $50 on the house or you got like $75 on the house or whatever. They would give us some allotment, you know, we had credit for so much. And we stopped doing it because nobody on the show would ever get a chance to have a single drink, because by the time Sarah or whoever get there, like, vodka tonic, and she'd be like, oh, I'm sorry, that was gone in the first 5 minutes of the show. And you just see Paul Halama back there just triple fisting it, you know. And it's
like
all,
Farva from Super Troopers, just totally. Like, yeah! Give me six schlitzes, whatever's free.
God damn. All right, well, let's do some actual news here, and then we'll do the next installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 by Mr. Stephen Wright. Before we do anything else, this is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
A 21-year-old Florida man accidentally...
Where?
Florida.
That's right.
Accidentally shot himself in the face while showing off his gun Wednesday night.
Is he dead?
I don't believe... No,
okay.
He's not.
All right.
Witnesses told deputies...
You sounded so disappointed.
I know. I realize I sound like a
like,
dick.
Darn.
Joshua Crackett was displaying a handgun from which he had removed the magazine.
There, Crackett, another Christmas Eve of shooting yourself in the face, is it?
Witnesses said Crackett placed the gun against his cheek and pulled the trigger, apparently forgetting there was a round in the chamber.
That's
and forgetting
awesome.
Where his forehead was, apparently. So this is how we kill ourselves.
Yeah, detective said the gunshot wound broke his jaw in two places.
Yeah,
He was airlifted to a hospital in West Palm Beach. He's expected to survive. Detective said there was no indication that the shooting was a suicide attempt.
That's wonderful.
It was more of a cry for help.
You're a terrible person.
You know, since we did have Paul and Sturm here, I believe we should do a penis watch.
All right. And by the way, somebody was already said, like, use the penis watch for today's penis watch. I'll get it. We'll do that for Monday. I'll have it chopped out and used for... I didn't play that on the Bob Miller Show on Monday. I'm sure the audience would enjoy hearing that.
What have you gotten us into?
I don't know. If it makes you feel better, I don't really care. So, you know, that's a thing that at this point,
At this point, I've realized that people either kind of like it or they kind of don't. Mm-hmm. And the folks who don't, they can lump it.
Yeah. Since we didn't have our top of the show discussion about our lives and things, yes, we are going to be filling in for Bob Miller Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
What?
7 to 11 a.m.
Shut the front door.
It's going to be very exciting.
And there was a meeting this morning with
was there? How would you know?
The producer and the guy.
Rumor has it.
Which I was going to be at 10:30, and uh-huh. I drove to the wrong place.
Yeah.
So I have Rick. Rick was there. So Rick, I'm counting on Rick to be prepared because I have no idea what's going on because I wasn't at the meeting.
I feel like the information given at the meeting should stay with those who were at the meeting, John. I feel like this is like if you don't go to school on pizza day, it's not like I have to bring a slice home for you.
Ouch.
So
yeah. Claws in, kitty, man.
So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we're gonna be filling in for Mr. Bob Miller on AM 860 KPAM.
Yes. The home of Hugh Hewson.
The voice of Portland. That'll be happening Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 7-11, and, you know, et cetera. So, by the way, I mean, I don't have time to get to the whole thing. We'll talk, I guess, more about it maybe Monday. But so I went there and you know, and it's like what we were just talking about. Like half the people in the building I've worked with, you know, before at some stage. One of the guys who works there was the producer of my ill-fated syndicated show at a certain point. And you know, and then there's Dennis, you know, the PD who you know, who worked here and then moved to DC and then now is back and whatever. And it was. I will say this one thing. The producer of the Bob Miller show, who seems a guy named Paul, seems like a very nice guy. But I think he actually is fairly new to the market. I don't think he's been here very long. And in no way is this meant to come off as like a "don't you know who I am" sort of a thing. It's just sort of it will be amusing to anybody who has listened to me for any length of time. So he's walking me through the whole, you know, what they call the clock, which is the, you know, at the top of the show we do an ID, then we do a little traffic, and then later on we'll have a break, and then there's a second segment, whatever. You know, because it's not my show. I mean, it's Bob Miller's show, and we're filling in. So he's showing me like how they do it, so we can kind of try to fit into that water flowing into that ice cube tray. But he's walking me through all the segments, and it's, you know, and it's for the most part a morning drive show, which means that, you know, that they try to get to a lot of different things, and they have a lot of news breaks and a lot of, you know, updates on, you know, on stuff like traffic and, you know, whatever. So at no point are you really ever talking for like more than like 8 or 9 or 10 minutes before you stop down for even just like 30 seconds, then you start again. So Paul's like walking me through the clock this morning. He's going, okay, so he's going to do your opening, and then you're going to have a first segment about 8 or 9 minutes long. Then you'll do some traffic. Then you'll come back after break. Then it's going to be a 10-minute segment of talk. Then you'll do some more news, then traffic, then a third segment of around 8 minutes, and then a stop set. And then you'll be – that's the end of the first hour. And I said, okay, that seems pretty straightforward. And then he looked at me, and it was a look of, I think, genuine – not concern, but just like he wanted to make sure that I was going to have a good experience and that the show was going to go well next week. And he said, so have you – now, have you done long talk segments before? Because this is 8 or 9 minutes, I mean, with no break. Have you done long form talk? And I thought he was sort of effing with me. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, this is like a full 10 minutes. He's like, this isn't, you know, you have to talk for 10 minutes here. You know, that's how long the segment is. He said, have you done that kind of talk before? And it was like,
talking earth minutes?
And I opened my mouth to say, I didn't even know what I was going to say. And I just went, yes. Yes, I can talk for 8 minutes.
So it was the internal sensor going, no, not the place for sarcasm, no.
Well, I just realized that, like, you know, there's really no way to convey the extent to which I can talk for 8 minutes. I mean, and 8 minutes past the point of anybody caring. 8 minutes past the point of anybody being interested even remotely in anything that
talk
I am saying.
Talk the hell out of 8 minutes.
So anyway, so that'll be that'll be a thing that happens on Monday, one way or the other.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Here is your penis watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson Radio
Take
program.
Take a look at my enormous penis.
It's like they're right here. It's like they never left.
My troubles start melting away. I take a look at my
It was so hard not to sing along with them.
I wanted to. Next time.
Going my way.
Here's Don Taylor with your penis watch.
Well, traveling around the net this week, you may have come across a map that will show you the various penis sizes of men around the world. Hmm. According to this map, the Congo, Ecuador, Ghana, Colombia, and Venezuela are the world's most well-endowed nations, while South Korea, Cambodia, Thailand, India, and Burman, basically all things that are in East Asia, are the least well-endowed. Americans are sort of in the lower quadrant with an average length of 5.1 inches.
Well, now let's down to be fair now.
The meh. Bracket, if you will.
If you look at it, though, it's surprising that we're not higher, A, because look at us, and also because if you think about it, America really should be dead center because we are a confluence of cultures and peoples from around the world.
Yeah, you'd think.
I mean, it's not like it's just white guys here. I mean, it seems
it
like
it was at first. But,
I mean, granted, we sort of blow the curve, unfortunately. But it seems like we should
so
be.
So to speak.
We
should. No.
It seems like we should be the mean. We should be the baseline here in America. So,
yeah,
well,
I agree.
Right.
The data was a lot of it was self-reported based on sized condom purchases. So,
well, how many sizes are there? Aren't there just regular and huge?
I don't know.
Not really.
And they might be different in different countries as well.
There's all different. There's various tapered sizes. We also have what they call Beyond 7, which means basically beyond 7 inches. You also have your Trojan Magnums.
Well, I knew the Magnum. Every guy knows the Magnum because every guy has gone to a girl's house and he's seen those sitting on the nightstand and he's like,
I wonder
who those are for.
I had a guy once.
I'm going to be a big disappointment.
Hopefully,
here.
She's a heroin trafficker. That's really what I'm hoping for at this point.
I was at the drugstore once many years ago when I was a younger, cuter thing. But I was at the drugstore and I was going over, and the lady products were kind of by the condoms, and there was this guy hovering about, and then he looked uncomfortable. He left, and I didn't really care. And then I walked over to go get the tampons, and then he came back over because I guess he steals them.
Wait, he was hovering by the tampons?
No, by the condoms, which were
all
next
the delicate
to,
items.
All the delicate
yes.
items. Okay. And he kind of walked away, and I went over and got what I was getting, and I guess he steeled himself to go over. But he's like, he very purposely went over, reached past me, and got the extra large condoms.
Pardon
and I kept
me,
thinking,
miss. Let me just grab these here out of your way.
And I just, and I was thinking, does he really need those, or is it just because there was a woman here that he decided he ought
my
to
mom's
going to
take
ones.
It in for me, like she does on my pants.
I guess I never really realized that there was such a spectrum, a range of that. But I guess it's also not just in America; it is, as you said, around the world. For example, I know now this is one of those things that you always hear, but this is in fact true. The Trojan Company has said that one of the developments that they made recently is the Trojan Company had to realize they had to start manufacturing a separate condom for India because men there are of a somewhat smaller size, probably not drastically so. But they couldn't. It was part of a discussion with the World Health Organization where they were talking about STD rates and birth rates and pregnancy rates and whatever, and they couldn't figure out why condom use was so incredibly ineffective in India. And it turns out that is a thing that is a populace that is sized somewhat differently as an average. And so,
like a suspender application or something.
So yes. Just like garters. So India had to have some separate Trojan plant created for them. Just started cranking out nothing but Indian condoms, which is just sort of. I mean, that's the thing where you just kind of go, God, you know, I feel bad for you, but boy, I'm glad that's not me.
Well, yeah, and according to this, Americans who are, like I said, in kind of the mid to lower quadrant, the data indicates that 50% of Americans are between 5 and 6 inches long. India, for example, their average size is 4 inches.
In your face.
Yeah.
And a second match published by the penis size map people. You can find this map, by the way, at everyoneweb.com.
What do you mean it's a penis-sized map?
World penis size. It's
being penisized, like have you been hypnotized?
I mean,
I've been penisized.
You're getting sleepy. You're getting very, very sleepy. Keep your eye on the penis.
Anyway, that's when you sexually assault James Brown.
There's a map.
Penisized.
But there's a map and there's bar charts showing you also size perception among racial groups. Like apparently blacks go, yes, I'm huge. Whereas Caucasians say, I'm average.
Well,
I'm okay.
Isn't that true?
For the most part.
It's very true. Usually,
I don't think that's perception. I think that's just looking.
There's also a second map published by these same people that attempts to correlate penis size with brain power. And Americans actually happen to finish in the upper echelon of IQs with a global ranking of 10th for IQ. So basically, our country is full of smart guys with average penises.
Thinking about how average our penises. I like to go a couple sizes.
That's the worst combination, too, because then you just stay up all night having intellectual discourse with yourself about your penis and your inferiority.
Is it good enough? Is it strong enough? I usually go a couple sizes bigger in the condom department and then just pack the end with newspaper. Just to sort of give the
like
illusion.
Like a Tom McCann shoe that doesn't quite fit.
Exactly.
At Christmas time, you just drop an orange down there into the end.
A little citrus never hurt anybody. Come on.
When I was in high school, my friend Rob, who lived with me for a while, and it was just an absolute deadbeat, just a dirtbag. Not a bad guy, but deeply stupid. Deeply stupid, always kind of getting into trouble because, again, he was deeply stupid, came from a stupid, trashy family. And, like, everybody had that friend. Sometimes you were that friend where it's like, Well, Jeff can't live at home anymore because the new stepdad and he don't get along. Can he bunk with us? You know, and it's like he lives with you for a while and then he steals the silver or something. And so Rob lived with us. Dumb guy, bad, trashy family, but also a really, really good-looking guy. Very attractive. And that
I hate
thing,
how that works.
And the thing is, he wasn't a dick about it. When I say he knew he was good-looking, I don't mean like he was a jerk. Like he wasn't, you know, like he wasn't like an ass about the fact that he was – he just – like to him, like he just didn't question. He's like, hey, you know, I've been, you know, I get the ladies really like me. And
kinda
he just
like Kelso from that 70s show.
Yeah, just sort of like it just sort of came to him like a, like an ocean wave. And he was like, well, I, you know, it's, you know, I'm just here and they just can't get enough of me. It's kind of cool. You know, and I'm like, yes, it is. I imagine it is kind of cool. So he lived with us and he asked to borrow my car one night. And so I lent him my electric blue 1974 Ford Maverick. And he
quit bragging.
Went to pick up this girl. And by the way, he had this whole science down. He clearly didn't need any of this, but he had this whole thing about like his whole thing about the cologne, which you wear in high school, of course. He would just stop by Payless and go to the sample counter and just like tss, 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 yeah, and then get back in the car. So my mom the
you
next
buy
day
buy any shoes today?
Classy.
No, get out.
The next day, my mom needs something out of the car. I forget what it is. It's like, you know, it's like a pair of shoes or something. She goes to the car, and so the car just smells like, you know, it smells like high karate and sin. And then she can't find her shoes, and so she looks in the trunk, and there is, I swear to God, just an empty box of Magnums in the trunk of my car.
Box of Magnums?
Well, you know, like the little, you know, like the three pack or whatever.
Did he make her a giraffe for her to take home with her?
I was just, you know, and so she says,
it's
like
a poodle.
She's like, well, I threw those Magnums away that I found in the trunk of the car. And that's such a mix of feelings, too, because on the one hand, you want to correct her and go, those aren't my Magnums. On the other hand, you want to go, those are totally my Magnums.
Those are extra my Magnums.
But then also it's your mom. And so it's just all kinds of strange. And so forth.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I totally empathize with that kind of a situation. It's very Brady Bunch-esque. Like, that's like the pack of cigarettes found in the
totally.
The Letterman's jacket.
It's on the coffee table when you come home. Son, something you want to talk to us about?
How awesome I am! Yeah, let's do it. Let's talk.
When guys come into the adult store where you work, do guys who come into that store still do the guy thing of shuffling around a little awkwardly before buying the condoms, or just be like, "I'm at a porn store, give me some rubbers"?
For the most part, yeah. We have them kind of separated out so that we've got like the polyurethane, the lambskin, which I think is just weird. Let's put the skin of another animal over your skin to do what you do. But no, more often than not. A lot of the guys, like at first, it kind of confused me because they just would buy like one condom because we had like singles also.
Who buys one condom?
Somebody who's going to go in the back and use that one condom by themselves.
Ah.
Yes, because it's easy for cleanup.
Okay, I see. No blotting required.
Exactly.
And sometimes there are other fellows hanging around back there, so perhaps it's not by yourself.
Yeah. Well, but even then, I mean. It seems like you always want to have more than one.
Well, not necessarily. Some guys are just Johnny Musket. You know, it's like fire that gun once and then, you know, head home.
Oh, are some guys like that? Yeah. I don't know what that's like.
Johnny Musket?
It takes about 20 minutes to
reload.
Most
men just go one round, do they? That's interesting. I didn't know that. anyway, but did you sell singles like next to the cigarettes? You know, it's like, you know,
yeah, pretty much.
Get your quarter, you know, your condom, 15 cents. But most guys will just they'll just be sort of, you know. It seems like if you're in the store anyway, you're just like sort of you're zen with it. You're like, yeah, I'm here to get rubbers and then, you know, go use them.
For the most part, like that's the least thing that people are kind of like hanky about when it comes to purchasing something at a porn store.
What's the most awkward item in terms of somebody being a little shifty, you know, or sort of, you know, embarrassed about buying something?
We have a lot of. I'd say Hispanic gentlemen that will come in and purchase masturbators, or as we refer to them, slabs. Also,
or if there's a, or there's a, you know, somebody like sexual aids of some kind, like the you know whatever, like a thing to you know, pleasure her, prolong the pleasure with whatever.
Those actually guys come in and they're almost excited to see like what's the newest fanciest one that you got.
I see the new Oldsmobiles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like what's the top of the line that you got here?
Awesome.
So there's a bunch that there's one that used to be very popular. Like guys when it was going off the market were buying it in like by the bucket load. And it was something called Azifa. And I don't know if that's like Native American for broken teepee or something, but it just always struck me weird. It's a word that doesn't mean anything, at least so I think. But there was another product that they
made. What is a Zefa? It is
a Zefa is a pill that lasts for 72 hours, and it basically makes it very easy to achieve
and sustain.
Yeah, and then it makes you be able to.
And it worked. It actually was a thing that worked.
Oh, very much so. And the thing is, but there's other ones that there's like Cockstar. There's Stiffer Hours, which is made by the same people. And there's a myriad. There's like
you're feeling from Bob Miller Monday morning on KPAM.
There's very clever people in the marketing department there.
Well, some of them are like El Toro or Raging Bull or
there's that. What is that thing? It's just called like the horny goat weed.
Horny goat weed is a characteristic or a component of a lot of these. But there are some that are mostly for novelty purposes because they don't work that well. But some have side effects. Like it usually has to do with the amount of niacin in the pill itself, because you can get like a body flush or nausea or splitting headache, which all of those, I don't know about you, but they just really get me in the mood to just like get down to some loving.
Well, niacin is that stuff that's in that like 5-hour energy or whatever is full of niacin. And it's like that. And that's the thing, people do that and it's like their skin gets really, really hot and they get really, really flushed sometimes and they sweat like uncontrollably depending.
Yeah, a lot of these pills, they're trying to increase the amount of blood flow, make it easier to get to that region of the body. But some will just figure, well, if we can't get this particular item to work, we'll just cram it full of niacin. That way there's blood flowing everywhere in the body.
Sort of the scorched earth approach.
Exactly. Then you salt it so that nothing
will grow. Fumigate the whole place here. That roach, wherever he is going to be gotten. Awesome.
For the most part, yeah.
So. But, I got to tell you, can I just say how great it is? We were just talking to Paul and Storm and Mike about living in the now with the internet and the science and the technology and the city of tomorrow today and so forth. Can I just tell you what a great time this is to be alive and what a great country this is in which to live? Because, I mean, it's like no boner, have a pill. Done. Yeah. Solved. Mm-hmm. Finished. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very much a George Jetson kind of like, oh, it's a meal and a pill.
As I often say about things like air conditioning, and electric lights. You know, 1,000 years ago, some guy who was vastly powerful, the guy didn't have a light bulb. There was no, if it was dark, it was effing dark, or you set a fire somewhere, and that was kind of it. Or
his bread came in loaf form, and that was it.
If it was hot, if it was hot, they basically just moved the irrigation ditch through it, ran through the middle of your living room, and they hoped that would work.
Like that one Bill Bryson book, At Home, he talks about that we watch old movies, and they show people in like their houses in like the 1700s and the 1800s and whatever, and there's just candles everywhere, and everything is lit, and everything is, there's light and stuff everywhere. And the fact is, no, candles and stuff were scarce, and you basically had to make them yourself. And so you would have like a candle in whatever room you happen to be in, and then you would take it with you into the next room, which doesn't lend itself well to like, say, cinematography when we're making these costume dramas for films.
Yeah.
But in real life, it was like, you didn't light your whole damn house like all the time because – you couldn't.
Well, and that's like, you just think of, if you read, a lot of times in sort of zoological books, they'll talk about, the history of various species and creatures. Now, certain things that get hunted to extinction because some guy heard a rumor at one point that if you ground up the shell of that particular tortoise and then snorted it, it would help you achieve and sustain your manhood.
Yeah.
And, of course, most of that crap doesn't work. But it's like, you just think about for thousands of years, the most powerful men in the world were sending, their Phoenician sailing vessels across the world to find, go get me some of that nutmeg. I hear it's great for my penis. And,
well, but the Japanese are just still killing the living crap out of stuff for reasons like that.
But, but now it's like you got a pill. It's like, how much is it? Well, it's $2. And you just take it, bam, and it works. I mean,
what kind of
science dream are we living in?
Cheapest one we carry is about $8.95.
Really?
Yeah.
And I don't know how much like Viagra or whatever is. I mean, that's like a, but it's
those are, yeah, those are like $40 a pill. We had people that were coming into the store.
It costs more for a quality erection.
Yes. I mean, you want quantity.
You got to pay for quality, Don.
Yeah. He comes out, it's got a little cape on, a little monocle.
I mean, really,
tiny banker's vest with a little pocket watch.
What ho! Like, I'm here now.
Puppycock and tempest in a teapot.
Whatever the cost is, the idea that like there is, when they say there's an app for that, like there is like a pill for that.
Yeah. And so, the thing is, it's the point where pretty much if you can swallow 95% of the problems that you have in life will be taken care of. The
Pay
step
attention
beyond
to that, Dawn. That is a good thing for you to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Remember that.
Yes.
I've always Monday through so. Wednesday. No, but also, I mean, once it gets to the point where swallowing becomes too much work and you know mm-hmm. that day is vastly approaching or quickly approaching, it'll be just like a spray or an ointment.
A patch.
Yeah, or like, a glowing part on the floor that you can just be, your fat gelatinous body can be rolled onto and then your problem will be beamed away.
The late, great Sam Kinison used to lament that there was, you know, he was talking about how there was laser heart surgery. And he's like, why don't I have just some sort of spray on Scotch Guard, you know, before sex? So, you know, instead of having to put a balloon over my member, which is awkward and, you know, whatever, you can just go like, shh, little aerosol, you're good to go. Doesn't matter. You know, it seems like we really ought to be there, but I don't want to be unappreciative of the advances we have made. They are legion. Awesome. There's your extended length
extended,
penis watch.
Yeah.
The ladies. Well,
take
you know,
a
more
look
pleasure.
At my enormous penis and my troubles start
your Maxim penis watch.
Ribbed with information.
Take a look at my enormous penis.
Filled with facts for her pleasure.
But now I have to stand way, way back when I go into the bathroom later on. So.
Engorged with wisdom.
Hey, we're going to be filling in for Bob Miller this coming Monday on AM 860 KPAM, the voice of Portland.
Yes.
Where they have asked us not to take the Lord's name in vain.
Did they ask us that?
They did. Now, to be fair, and I want to be very, very, very fair about this. It's too, I don't want to take cheap shots. They actually I asked about this. I said, so tone-wise, what are we talking about here? Because it's not like the Rick Emerson show. As I said, it's Bob Miller's show. Where he's gracious enough to I don't know who suggested, but you know, we're filling in. And I said, so, you know, I don't want to go into somebody else's house and just wreck the place. So you just tell me, like, what should I hew to in terms of the tenor of the program? And he said, he's like, oh, no, he's like, do what you do. And he's like, I'm, you know, and it's like, because Dan's listened to the show for years and years. And he's like, hey, he's like, you do what you do and just, you know, do whatever you would normally do. And he said, please don't take the Lord's name in vain. So that's the only, it's like, if you just stay away from that. He's like, everything else is good. And I said, really? He goes, that's pretty much it. So, you know, hey, I can do that.
Right.
So
really? Like, that's the deal breaker? But anything else?
It's strange. You know, here's the thing. Strangely enough, and that is not a thing that is specific to KPAM or their ownership or their company or whatever. I have worked for a lot of radio stations over the years. I mean, several anyway, where I could say a lot of things. But if I said what the general manager at KOTK referred to as the GD word, like to him, like that was the... I mean, and we, you know, it's not like we do a deliberately offensive show. It's not like I have some, you know, like idiot shock jock or whatever. But I mean, we discuss things in a frank and adult fashion.
Yeah.
But he had no problem with anything I did. But if I said like goddamn, or if I said, well, Jesus Christ, or whatever, he would just like, and he was, he didn't tell me not to do it. But he sat me down in the office and he just said, you have to understand. He's like, I'm just telling you that for a lot of people, regardless of how broad their idea of, you know, humor or comedy, or whatever, he's like, a lot of people just find that to be a thing that they cannot listen to because it makes them. It's too off-putting. He said a lot of people find it so jarring to hear because of their upbringing or the way they were raised or their religion.
That's a fair assessment.
And to his credit, he didn't ask me not to say it or tell me not to say it, much less. He just said, like, a lot of people find that word very, very jarring and unsettling and coarse. Just think about that. And so actually, out of deference to him, I actually scaled back my use of that. And I think – and I worked at it when I worked at Entercom. They just gave me not a reaming, but I mean they full on told me like they – what's his name? Jack Hutcherson gave me a big don't say retard speech, which didn't take. So
clearly that stuck.
Yeah. But no, they just said the thing about respecting the name of the Lord thy God. And other than that, I think we're pretty much good. So penis, 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 penis.
What was that – Onion headline that you mentioned yesterday?
Oh, there was the best Onion headline the other day, and it was just, you said it was sort of almost like a Zen, it was like a Zen koan or something, some gay retard mocked. See, it's great. It's awesome. Yeah. There was a great, I'm not
it
much
just,
of a,
it's funny, and then it just sort of builds in your head.
Oh, man.
It's
like an Altoid of humor.
I'm not much of a fan of Ira Glass, because I find him just, he's a little too precious for me. But my wife is a big fan of, she's a big fan of This American Life. And she had me listen to This American Life episode, which I gladly paid money for, because that's what one does for quality online programming. For like 99 cents or whatever, I got this. A single hour cost me 99 cents. Do you believe that?
Wow.
I mean, it was, you know, I was willing to do it, but come on.
I don't want to compare apples and oranges here, but...
Come on.
But he spent a day with the Onion writing staff, and he did a whole story about the Onion writing staff, and it was actually really fascinating, because he talked about something that I had heard, but that I assumed was an urban legend. And it's not. What I had always thought was an urban legend was
the Onion story selection process, where all the writers get into a room, and there it's like a miniature auditorium, basically. And they all get in a room, and one by one, they take turns going up and standing at the front of the room with their notebook, and they reel off headlines. And the deal is that two people in the room have to laugh at it. And if two people in the room laugh at the headline, you don't get anything else. You don't get the story. You don't get over. You can say if there's a visual, but you don't get to, you just get to read the headline. And if two people laugh, it makes it to the next round. It may not make it to the newspaper because most don't. But two people have to laugh to make it to the next round. And if two people don't laugh, then it gets cut. No matter how good you are, the editor in chief said that he'll go up there with something he thinks is gold. And he's like, you know, he runs the whole place, and it's like nobody will laugh, and he just has to swallow the fact that his joke didn't make the cut. And there was this, and so Ira Glass asked this one. He said, like, are there headlines that you are just that you still can't believe didn't make the cut? And this a woman who's a writer at The Onion said, and this is again, this is one of those things. It's sort of like the thing, the gay retard mock thing, where it's sort of almost it's so strangely stripped down that it sort of becomes great the longer you think about it. This is what NPR, what I would call an NPR smile joke, not a guffaw joke, but it is really funny. She said that the headline she pitched was "Spork Used as Knife," which I think is funny.
It is.
And it's not, again, it's not like laugh out loud funny immediately, but there's just something that's hilarious about that. Spork used as knife. And I mean, and the thing about it is I visualize seeing that headline in the paper, and it makes me laugh. But she said that not a single person, I mean, there wasn't like a sound. And she did like a whole like, come on! You know, like try, and there's, but I guess there's no, like if it doesn't make anybody laugh, it does not matter what you say in its defense. Like it doesn't make the cut. And so you can't bring it back the next week.
You can't gerrymander. You can't do anything. Basically, it's you say it, you wait, and then like you move on.
That's it. Like, and if nobody laughs, like you got to go to the next one. And it was so awkward. He had audio of people going, you know, okay, well, so the joke is nation's girlfriends demand more quality time. And then it was sort of like that's not funny. And, you know, and he's at the front of the room going, okay, no, but the joke is, and then they immediately, the whole room just descended on him. Like, we know what the joke is. It's not funny. he was like run out of town on a rail, basically. But I guess that's just, you know, but of course the result of that is like The Onion is the most consistently hilarious thing in the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, anyway. And I'm including Monday's Bob Miller program in that. So,
which you'll get to listen to for free.
Fools.
I know.
I know they could be charging for this gold. Well, let's
soak it
of,
up now.
Are we going to be giving them like our Rick Emerson Show email addresses?
What do you mean?
When we're on
giving
when
them,
we're, you know,
what, them?
Well, the listeners when we're on the Bob Miller Show,
non-subscribers.
Are we going to be giving out our email addresses?
I don't know. Why wouldn't we?
I don't know. I'm just looking forward to our mail.
You don't have to read that stuff. You got to see that big button that says delete. No. Let me tell
jump,
you.
Yeah,
jump.
But I never know until I open it. You almost never know until you open it whether it's going to be like mean and angry or complimentary. And I want to read the compliments.
Let me tell you about a little thing called an email filter, Don. That's your friend.
He's the bouncer of your self-respect.
If it includes the phrase "you suck," dump in this folder.
Yeah, I mean that's you know seriously the number of filters that I have set up that all end in send directly to trash. I mean it's that's really the only way that I can it's the only way that I can keep my life manageable. Don, let's do one more real brief story here while I rack up the sound, and then we'll get to Humor Me Comedy 101. Here is Don Taylor.
Young vandals have been putting lives at risk by ripping up daffodils planted on Colchester, England's Avenue of Remembrance.
Rapscallions!
And hurling them at cars.
Who hates daffodils? That just seems weird. I mean,
who said they were eating them?
Hates.
Oh, hates.
I'm just saying daffodils seem like a strange thing to go after. I mean, it's like, what have they ever done
well,
to you?
I mean, it's small animals I can kind of see, but like just plant life, really?
Well, the town's mayor, Sonia Lewis, said she was horrified to be told about the incident by residents and motorists. She said, one gentleman told me he had to pull to the side of the road because there were so many flowers thrown at his windscreen. I went down there and there were flowers strewn across the road. It was unpleasant to see such wanton damage.
So they're not just ripping them up and just sort of casting them helter-skelter, rat-a-tat-tat. They're using them as projectiles at the motorists.
To throw them at cars.
That seems like a strangely – how much distance can you really get with a daffodil?
I don't know.
Doesn't seem aerodynamic.
No. A police spokesman said if anyone does see people doing this sort of thing, we would urge them to let us know. The obvious danger is drivers can be distracted, swerving to avoid what can be coming towards their windscreen and crashing.
Also, in your attempt to look like a badass, you're just going to seem like a really peeved florist.
Yeah, you're daffodil throwers.
Janet Wood is outside and she's pissed.
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay.
I just imagine the small British town, English town, with the people having, like, you know, a town meeting and folks standing up and saying, "What about those vandals throwing the daffodils?" And then everyone just getting really outraged about the daffodil thing. It just, I like that.
There's... Spork used as knife.
Gary Turdmock.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. And so forth. Without further ado, we turn the microphone over to Mr. Big Jim Willig with this week's installment of Humor Me Comedy 101.
Thank you very much, Mr. Emerson. Now, it is very easy to get lost in the setup punch world of comedy. One of the first lessons that you learn is to simply just cut out the clutter. The shorter the distance from the beginning of a joke to the payoff, the harder the punch, thus giving the audience no time to see where the laugh will come. This brand of humor is called one-liners. Now, the blunt, sheer force of one-liners makes a deeper impact than the standard joke and leaves the audience open to actually learn something. When properly executed, the material sounds less like a group of jokes and more like the teachings of a comedy prophet. And few comics utilize this abstract form better than Stephen Wright.
Thanks. I like to skate on the other side of the ice. I like to reminisce with people I don't know. Granted, it takes longer. I like to fill my tub up with water, then turn the shower on and act like when a submarine has been hit.
With his whisper quiet volume and his almost disinterested delivery, Stephen Wright is far in a class all his own.
I hate when my foot falls asleep during the day because that means it's going to be up all night. When I get real bored, I like to drive downtown and get a great parking spot, then sit in my car and count how many people ask me if I'm leaving.
Stephen is an anomaly in that on paper, his joke should come off as cheesy or not even work at all. So it's his delivery that makes it work. But here's the thing, he has no delivery.
I just got out of the hospital. I was in a speed reading accident. I hit a bookmark. I went into a place to eat. It said breakfast anytime, so I ordered French toast during the Renaissance.
Watching Stephen Wright do comedy is like having Bigfoot give you a PowerPoint presentation on the benefits of weather stripping. And yet I laugh every single time.
Call the wrong number today. I said, "Hello, is Joey there?" And a woman answered. She said, "Yes, he is." I said, "Can I speak to him, please?" She said, "No, he can't talk right now. He's only 2 months old." I said, "All right, I'll wait." One time right in the middle of a job interview, I took out a book and I started reading. The guy said, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, "Let me ask you one question. If you're in a vehicle and you were traveling at the speed of light, then you turned your lights on, would they do anything?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Forget it then, I don't want to work for you."
And with that, I turn the spotlight on the two people sharing the studio with me at this time, Mr. Rick Emerson and Don Queen for a Week Taylor. Your thoughts on the live wire, Stephen Wright.
Don Taylor in the back.
Stephen Wright is one of those comedians that I've always admired sort of intellectually rather than found, you know, hilarious, laugh out loud, funny. I do remember reading an interview with him, I think sometime in the early 80s. It was when he was still like at some kind of at that apex of popularity at any rate. And he did like a lot of comedians. He talked about how he just walked around all day with a notebook in his pocket and just jotted down words and phrases and weird thoughts as they would occur to him. And the thing about Stephen Wright is that it's almost like he completely deconstructed observational comedy and just boiled it down to a level that is just absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah.
Because his entire act is just him saying things. There isn't really... The jokes are in the observations. They're not even in the choice of words so much and the rhythm of his language. It's purely in the sort of absurd, the genuine absurdity of his observations. So,
absolutely, and it, the thing is, it's like with Stephen, he breaks every single rule there is in comedy. You know, just everything from like his cadence to the fact that he speaks, you know, very, very softly. There's no energy. There's no punctuation with what he's saying. He's not like really ramping you up in any way. Everything kind of exists in your head. And all he's doing is just kind of like changing the filter on which you see these things every day and just augmenting them just so slightly so that it's almost like you're doing all the work. And yet he is the one that gets to take all the credit for it.
Well, it's almost it's strange. It's like listening to some sort of a – we were talking about the news bot yesterday. But it's like listening to, you know, to one of those like books on tape, yeah. You know, just read by just a guy with no inflection or just read by a sort of – by an early version computer voice program where you're just – where you are – it is all the nuance, all of the delivery, all of the whatever is stripped away, which in a way is sort of great because it forces you – to judge the material on its own merit. In other words, it's just the writing. I mean, because as much as people say, well, it's that great deadpan delivery, like the thing about the deadpan delivery is it's a trademark, but it's not actually funny. Yeah. The deadpan delivery itself, once you get past the first 5 minutes of like, oh, hey, did you hear this way this guy talks? The deadpan delivery itself is not really funny. It's like they would say about there's that thing about Helvetica, where they say the whole reason that Helvetica font is so great is that you don't notice it. The Helvetica font is designed to be totally and perfectly neutral. Most fonts are designed to make a statement. They're aggressive, or they're funny, or they're whimsical, or they're businesslike, or they're edgy in some way, or they're childlike. Helvetica is designed to be absolutely neutral, and the reason that it's so popular is because by dint of being aesthetically neutral, it lets the text stand on its own without any sort of inflection or coloring, and the text only means what it says. It doesn't – there's no additional layer of meaning or implication put on top of it. That's the thing with Stephen Wright, is that like you listen to that guy, and there is no difference between listening to him and reading all of his stuff written down.
Yeah.
It's purely and totally about the writing, which is kind of admirable in a way.
And I think it was that same interview that I read with him. He talked about the biggest thing that he worked on as far as just crafting everything he did was the specific choice of words. And like he said, the one thing where one of his classic jokes about went to a restaurant, they said they served, you know, breakfast anytime. You know, I had pancakes in the Renaissance. He said, you know, and he actually had, like, worked on that for a while. It's just like, he could have said, I had scrambled eggs in the Middle Ages. But it just wasn't as funny.
Right.
For some reason, the words pancakes and Renaissance seemed to be just the golden combination.
Yeah.
And that's what he knew. He, like, locked the joke in.
Pretty much anyone that does this comedy knows that it isn't always what is said, or it is, you know... They say that it's not always what is said, it's what isn't said. It's so hard. That's why you can't even quantify it at times. Letterman is one of those guys that has always said that he's terrified that tomorrow he's going to wake up and all of his humor is just going to be gone. Because there's just no way to hold on to it. It's just the way that the brain kind of fires. It's a cylinder. It's a
You don't even know why it works when it works and why it doesn't when it doesn't sometimes.
Yeah, and all it does is it forms this image in your mind that causes your body to make a sound that for whatever reason kind of keeps the whole thing moving like a perpetual motion machine. And it's staggering. And it's staggering in the fact that it's an intangible, like oxygen, and yet it's just as much needed in order to keep any kind of a creative mind alight. And that's, with like you said, with Stephen Wright, it's totally about what it is that's being written. It's almost like listening to a book.
The other thing about him, and I believe him when he says this, because he's... He seems very sincere when he says that he did not intend for the deadpan thing to be a shtick.
Yeah.
That it was just sort of the way he described it as, he was so nervous that rather than with a lot of people, they get nervous and they get, you know, faster or louder, or they become more, you know, profane, or they become whatever. He was just so nervous that it was like this wheel that was going so fast it was standing still, where his nervousness just came out as just this absolute absence of inflection. And that they basically just tripped and fell into a style. So, you know, even if that's true, it is a particular kind of, even if it's inadvertent genius, of genius, because he has done what is really rare and what everybody tries to do. This is a thing that everybody aims to do as an entertainer, but very few people do it, where he is like a category killer. I mean, there's no one else who can do that. Anybody else who does that is just like, oh, you're just doing Stephen Wright. You know, he is that delivery. That is his, and it's like he just he owns it as surely as if it were trademarked. And there's no one else that can come out on stage and just do this sort of Ritalin Henny Youngman thing that he does, because it just wouldn't work, because it would just it would be so apparent that you were watching somebody ape his style. And it is it's also amazing that in you have however long, you know, comedy's been happening in America in a mainstream sense, all the way through like the Borscht Belt and vaudeville and whatever, up through, you know, the 70s and the 80s when he was ascendant. It's strange that nobody else ever did that, or nobody else that we're aware of ever did it. That, like, because it, it's the, you know, the genius sometimes is, there's a name for this paradox, and I forget what it's called, but it's called, it's something, it's like the Galileo paradox or something. But it's the idea that an invention which seems obvious, and so people get a little annoyed about it. They go, well, anybody could have thought of that. And they go, yeah, but like nobody did. You didn't. Yeah. That guy did. And it's the idea that is only obvious in retrospect. And then it becomes almost angering that no one thought of it, or puzzling, mystifying that no one thought of it, because it was like right there in front of you the whole time. So the idea that he would just say, well, everybody works on their delivery. What about I work on removing my delivery?
Yeah.
Which is so simple, such an inversion of the classic process. And yet, he did it, and he did it first and best to our knowledge, and so much so that no one else can ever do that again, because that's just what he does, and he alone has the sort of hold on that.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's breaking all of the rules that at the same time, because the quiet, delicate, you know, approach that he brings his humor out is something that it's almost like you're taught, okay, don't do what he's doing right now.
Right.
Basically, everything that he's doing, do the opposite of, and that's everybody else. So he's just like, okay, well, if everybody is this hero, I'm going to be the anti-hero and do it my way. And like you said, it becomes so obvious. And, you know, just like that, you know, I don't know, it's like doing comedy underwater. Like, no one's ever done that. I'll give that a shot. And sure enough, it's probably been tried, but never to the level of degree that he's had. So it's almost like the world was waiting for him to come along and bring that to the forefront. And like you said, it becomes annoying that and obvious that it was because it was always there that he was the first to get it going.
It's also kind of great because he is strangely timeless. I mean, he doesn't do a lot of pop culture references. I think, you know, he said that he started to work in some references to, like, you know, to his iPhone or whatever. But he doesn't do a lot of, you know. So that Lindsay Lohan is real, you know. The great thing about that is, if you were to imagine Stephen Wright's comedy being, you know, you're listening to that in 1950, or you're listening to that between your Tom Lehrer and your Bob Newhart, it fits right in. I mean, he absolutely would work as a comedy artist in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. You can very easily imagine that guy being listened to by the sort of gray flannel suit Madison Avenue set in 1961.
Yeah.
It's a very timeless, classic kind of thing, even though it seems like a thing that is sort of a result of our ironic postmodern age. I think it's just so – it's not effortless, but it is – again, because it's neutral, it works everywhere. The other thing that is impressive to me about Stephen Wright – is that, and it's not, I'll say that I'm also with Don. I should say that as a result, despite everything I'm sort of saying, I don't know that I'm a fan in the sense that I don't really sit around and listen to Stephen Wright. I mean, I can only take so much of that. It kind of wears, I get full up on that meal pretty quickly. But I admire Stephen Wright for the same way that I admired a guy like Henny Youngman or Rodney Dangerfield. Dangerfield's probably the bad example, because Henny Youngman was very. It was just a series of one-liners. Just set him up and knock him down for, like, you know, an hour and a half on stage. And that was the thing. And Dangerfield, a lot of his act was that way, too. And that really is writing intensive. I mean, you have to constantly be producing. You have to be at home, unless you just want to do the same 35 jokes every week, every night. You got to be at home coming up with something that is short, perfectly crafted, uses exactly the right word, is understandable, is relatable, works with the things on the other side of it, and then on top of all that, hey, be funny. And it's like impossible to do. No one can do that, you know?
Totally. And the fact that the one thing that Stephen has on his side is that there are no segues.
Right.
Like, one joke doesn't lead into another. He'll basically be like here 1 minute and on the moon the next, and then, like, you know, totally abstract right after that. So with that, he has that, you know, level of, like, I can be anywhere at any point in time. But yeah, if it's short form, there's nothing gets a chance to really expand. He doesn't really extrapolate anything out. It's usually just like Don said, like just the pure boiled down crux of the joke thrown out there and then moved on. So with that, it must be incredibly exhausting. And why he doesn't have like 117 different comedy albums. He does have a fair share. He has books and everything else out there. But at the same time, I like the fact that it's not dated. It is, like you said, it's something that somebody could pick up 20 years from now or 20 years ago and be still entertained at the same level as they were when he first brought the joke out.
He also has to – the thing about Stephen Wright and any guy like that, the thing about Stephen Wright is he has to be funny. He has to be good because Stephen Wright can't get on stage and fall back on like, hey, how about those Lakers? Yeah. Anybody here from out of town? Hey, you sure are ugly. You know, it's like he can't vamp the way that that another performer could because that's not what he does. And it's not what you get the sense he probably couldn't do it. So as a result, it forces him to make sure, like the Onion, that every joke is as good as he can possibly make it. There's no fat. There's no filler. You could almost, in a way, you could almost compare him to the Ramones. That the Ramones had to, you know, whatever everybody thinks about them, they had to take a lot of care in crafting their songs because, you know, they couldn't just fall back on having a guy solo for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, Led Zeppelin had a bad night. Doesn't matter. You just sit there and have Jimmy Page wank with the bow for, you know, 2 hours. Everybody thinks, oh, it's awesome. You know, well, it really wasn't awesome a lot of the time. You know, it was just filling because they didn't have it that night. And it's like, if you play 2 minute songs, you better have it because you can't hide behind a 2 minute song. And you can't hide behind what Stephen Wright does. He's either funny or he's not. It either works or it doesn't.
Absolutely.
Awesome. We're geniuses.
We are.
Now, I like how the fact that
our penises are average size, though.
Well, yours maybe.
I like even talking about Stephen seems to get, you know, at least me, kind of tongue-tied because you're almost drawn into his way of thinking. It's almost like a black hole, the way that, even invoking his name tends to make people kind of flustered unless you talk slow,
right,
delicate, deliberate, the way that he performs. So I think in that sense, he is his own niche. He is his own chapter in the book of comedy, I feel.
Big Jim Willig can be found online at BigJimWillig.com. BigJimWillig.com. What else is coming up in your world? What are you?
I have a couple. I'm working on getting a couple of gigs booked here in April. So as soon as those are nailed down, I will be bringing those locations and times to you.
Fantastic.
Yeah, as soon as I can.
Excellent. Big Jim Willig, Humor Me, Comedy 101. We should say at this point that Humor Me, Comedy 101, as well as the rest of the Rick Emerson Cavalcade of Amusements, is brought to you by Squires Electric. SquiresElectric.com is the website, or 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. Speaking of Joe Squires, I don't know if you heard this or not. So Joe Squires was on the show Wednesday? Tuesday? Wednesday, I think. But he was here, and because he worked on, he worked on nuclear submarines, and he was electrical engineer. And he actually, I mean, it just never ceases to amaze me. He just sat in the studio and just explained to us, I mean, in sort of our, you know, down to Don and I's level, how nuclear power worked and like what happened inside a nuclear reactor and what happened when it went wrong and like what in Japan, like when they talk about, well, there's a breach or there's a, you know, fissure or there's, you know, there's a leak of something or the rod has been exposed to the core. I was like, well, I don't know what any of that means. And he's like, well, here's how it be. And in a way that didn't actually convey the sort of like, Rick, you're really dumb.
Yeah, there's no condescension.
Yeah, I mean, though, look, I mean, I am ripe for condescension. And he didn't, you know, it was, but really he just, and then so a guy.
You really are.
I really am. But a guy actually sent me an email about it, like right afterward, because we were talking to Joe, and I was like, you know, I was like, you really, like, this is fascinating. Like, you should do like a nuclear Joe's, you know, fun fact of the day or something, or just, you know, some sort of a little bit of amusement, involving this. And somebody, I have to see if I actually saved the email, but I forwarded it to myself because a guy had commented on this, and he said something very similar to that. He said, like, if Joe Squires put together like some sort of a, like a nuclear fact of the day or like a newsletter of the day, like, I would absolutely subscribe to it because, and this is so much of what guides this show, whether we're talking about Stephen Wright or whether we're talking about electricity or whether we're talking about, you know, Paul and Storm and how they put their, you know, their songs together. There's something really great about hearing a guy who just absolutely understands what he's talking about. I mean, it's that, you know, of where it just, you can just feel like small crevasses in your knowledge bank just being filled in. Sort of an intellectual grouting that takes place. look, there are ravines of ignorance. Let me fill those with tasty facts. And it's really, it's great. So the point of this is when you call him to, you know, come out to your house or your business or whatever, they're going to fix something, they're going to work on something, they're going to install something. I mean, you're talking to a guy in a company because he surrounds himself with other smart people and they know what they're doing and they understand.
Good-looking people, too.
That's, I mean, they're handsome men.
They are.
No getting around that.
They are handsome. And
that, rugged and intellectually smart.
And that Donna, she's
Donna's a pip.
Don't let her fool you. She's a Hellcat.
She's a biscuit.
Is she really?
Yes.
I don't know what that means.
That's something Mike Russell says that always cracks me up. He said, oh, yeah, she's a biscuit.
Isn't that what they said on the Cosby Show? No, that's a burger.
Wow.
She's a burger. No, there was a whole thing where Theo and Cockroach were calling a girl a burger. And then, like, what's her name? Who's the tight-ass middle daughter?
Vanessa?
Denise? No, Denise is the older.
Vanessa is the middle daughter, yeah.
It was Tempest Bledsoe.
Yeah, and Rudy was the youngest one.
Yeah, and so Tempest Bledsoe got all, you know, she got her panties in a wad about, you know, about that. No, in fact, I don't think it was. In fact, I think it was that she thought it was great, and it was,
Denise?
Lenny Kravitz's, I'm going to say Radon Chong, but it's not Radon Chong. No. It's Lisa Bonet. Lisa Bonet was the one, she was going to college, and so she understood a thing or two about feminism. And there was, like, there was this whole, like, debate about it. Was it wrong to call a girl a burger?
Bring it down a million.
The Bob Miller Program will be hosting all of this Monday for as many as 9 minutes in a row, apparently.
Consecutive minutes.
Do you think you can talk that long?
What if I can't? What if I just get there like Letterman and my humor has just...
7.5 and you're just sweating.
I'll just throw it to Don.
We know how well that'll go.
Guitar solo and go!
We should totally go and just choke. We should go and just like... I don't have anything to say. And just run out of the room. One of us should develop...
Goes the diamond.
We should totally fake like a tic or like a speech impediment.
I'll just start crying.
You know, just sort of just do a...
Greetings!
Or give your...
fellow listeners.
Real sibilant S.
Welcome to the Recovers in Town.
And, or just occasionally just do kind of a... between...
That's it, I'll
you
do
You should
that.
Be the Tourette's chick.
I'll do the Tourette's chick.
Have you ever heard that?
Yeah.
Oh, it's awesome. You should totally be the...
Woodaloo!
Okay. That's Monday on AM860 KPAM.
Hide your mocking laughter.
Portland. All right. Squires Electric can be found at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609.
We're doomed.
Okay. Well, yeah.
No one can torpedo my career like me.
I was just going to say, but the good news is they can't fire me. I mean, you know. All they can do is just, you know, not validate my parking that day, so I'm okay. That is coming up Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You can look for details, I guess, at the kpam.com or possibly not. I don't know.
Yeah, well.
Okay. We want to thank our special guests, Paul and Storm, as well as Mike Furman, who's here, and Big Jim Willig, who can be reached online at bigjimwillig.com. Monday, we will – and by the way, so we'll be doing the Bob Miller Show Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, but we'll also be here doing Legion of News and doing this show as well because sleep is for lightweights. Mm-hmm. Monday, we'll be joined by music editor from The Oregonian, Mr. Ryan White, also Aaron Duran for the week in Geek. Somebody asked about a particular Paul and Storm song. They played opening band. They sang the Enormous Penis. A song. My friend played one of his songs. So as we close this out, I don't know. Did you see them the last time they're here? I don't know if you did or not. I think it might have been Cheryl.
Think so.
That I yeah. I think Cheryl was there. Have you seen them perform Frogger the Musical?
I haven't seen it. I listened to it online because it was something they did for Song Fu.
God
yeah.
Damn. It's like it's the most brilliant. So I'm going to play that at the end of the show. But here's the thing. As great and as funny as they are, just like sitting here or you listen to the record or whatever, I know this sounds like such a cliche, but really you got to trust me with it. You got to see them live.
They do a hell of a show. And then they've got these other people with them too who are all awesome. So tonight's show is – nobody said anything about giving us putting on a list or anything. God damn it.
You are the list, Don. Just show up. Just
they were on my radio show this morning.
Just go there and just to, you know.
Let me in.
And say that you're I'm for the Bob Miller Show. F you.
God damn it, I'll say very loudly. I'm with KPAM.
Are you
God
a Jew?
Damn it.
All right. Well, in any event, this is trending fast in an ugly direction. So we're going to end the show by playing Frogger the Musical. This is from Paul and Tom. And believe it or not, this is genius and it's brilliant. And it is Frogger the Musical. And it's only 3 minutes long because they're goddamn awesome. So Paul and Storm. And again, see them tonight, Friday the 25th at the Aladdin Theater. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon, at the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kunikoa. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of the day's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program, plus play all of the episodes from all the shows this week, over the weekend, along with some stuff from the archive that we sort of rotate through. So don't forget, if you listen to the show via podcast, you download it, or you listen maybe to the live stream or whatever when we're actually doing it, don't forget that especially if you're downloading and you're listening to it later recorded, the live stream actually runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So anytime, day or night, your craven desire for this program can be satisfied. So that's at rickemersonshow.com. Until then, we thank you for listening, and please spread the word. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. It is Friday, March 25th, 2011, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you Monday. Bye now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Why the chicken might have done it, I just couldn't say. But if I'm gonna make it home, this is the only way. 5 lanes of traffic, an embankment, then a stream. It's like it's some kind of amphibianic fever dream. The total lack of law enforcement on this road's a crime. I'd write a letter, but I simply haven't got the time. Give me a call tomorrow if I haven't died, and I can tell you how I made it to the other side.
Up, left, up, right, 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 down, left, up, 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 left.
If I make it to the other side,
up, left, up, right, 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 down, left, up, up, left, up, right.
I hope I make it to the other side,
up, right, 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 down, left, up, up, left, up, right,
I gotta make it to the other side.
Excuse me, miss, I couldn't help but notice that you seem to be out here all alone. And it seems to me, in a world so cold and lonely, no one should have to do this on their own. We're already past the highway, so if you are going my way, there's room inside if you wanna ride. I'll take you to the place we're heading toward. Hop on board, let's share this road together. Hop on board, we'll bear this load forever. If you're with me, there'll never be a river we can't. They'll never stop us, baby. Hop on board. Hop on board. Now that you have got my back, I see a new plan of attack. And suddenly